probably the most successful business education program out there. It's been going longer, it's the most expensive, I think, out there, and has probably some of the highest level students and a great deal of partner with corporations. What are you talking about?
I'm very pleased to be here, and it's a little strange that I'm here because I am not an accountant. In fact, if I had to take an accounting course, I probably would be in trouble. And I'm actually a communication person. I started working at Duke University teaching a management communication course. And in 1992, our faculty started talking about a distance program, and I really thought they'd lost their minds. I thought there was no way, as a communication person, that this would actually work. In 1994, they came to me and said, "Will you start working on teaching virtual teams to work together?" Well, at that point in time, there wasn't much research out there on how that worked really well, so I decided to give it a try and play with it, and worked with our first set of global executive MBA students on how to build teams and work in a virtual team environment. Within 6 months of that, I was at the dean's office begging to work with this program because it was one of the richest educational environments I'd ever seen. And since then, I worked with the global executive MBA program as assistant dean for the first 4 years of its operation. I've now worked with the cross-continent program, which is our second online MBA that we just did. In fact, I just finished orientation and teaching my virtual teams course there. And now I'm actually working on the other side of things. I'm working with faculty to take their content and improve it for the online environment. So I've got a lot of different perspectives on things. I'm kind of like Bob, I can talk forever on this. But let me just try to tell you what I want to do, is first give you a brief background on our internet-mediated learning environments. The reason I'm doing that is not as an advertisement. I hate it when people do that, but ours is a little bit different than what you could describe. First of all, we're on a global scale, so we can't do a lot of things that these guys are doing. But let me just tell you what we do and what our philosophy is, because I'm definitely biased about some things, but that will definitely come out. And this will give you kind of a fair disclosure of what's happening. Then, for those of you who are either teaching now or planning to teach in distance, I want to give you kind of the benefit of our experience, because we were one of the first ones out there. I think Purdue was also out there with us as well. And we hit a lot of speed bumps, but we learned a lot from it, and my goal is to share some of those lessons learned. If you have questions, please feel free to ask. Okay? We have started two different programs. Our Global Executive MBA program started in 1996. We graduated now 5 classes from there. We started a cross-continent MBA program in 2000, and that's we graduated 1 class from there. In addition, we had some non-degree executive education programs. That's prior to our spin-off of our custom executive education programs. I'm sure you read in the Wall Street Journal, perhaps, that the Pupil School is having trouble. That's actually not the Pupil School anymore. That's now Duke Corporate Education, which is a for-profit thing. We're actually in okay shape.
Plus, that was a lot of live stuff that was in trouble.
Yeah. And actually, they're not in trouble. But
no.
But that was a reporter.
They're in real money trouble.
Yes. Okay. But we've had over 800 e-learning MBA students, over 1,200 e-learning executive participants. We've done for several large corporations, just global educational programs. We've had students participating from a total of 43 different countries, and we've held residency sessions, and those are the face-to-face sessions, on 4 different continents. Let me just explain how the Global Executive Program works. We start in Durham, North Carolina, and we have 3 weeks of classes. 1 week of that is orientation, how to use the technology, how to work in virtual teams, and we try to prevent a lot of the team problems they've been talking about by giving them some skills to manage conflict. We ask them to create a team charter for how they're going to work together, and then later, if they are having trouble, I have something to go back and intervene with them. Okay, we agreed to this, so let's go back to that. So we work in Durham, North Carolina. They have 2 weeks of classes, very intense classes, and for the next 10 weeks, they work online, and then we all meet in Europe, usually in Frankfurt.
A rock life.
It's not as glamorous as it sounds. When I first went to Prague, I got out of the hotel for 3 hours, and 2 of those were from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. So it's not as glamorous as it sounds. They work 2 weeks face-to-face, another 2 weeks online, then we go to Asia, Beijing and Hong Kong typically, 10 weeks online, and then we go to South America, Sao Paulo and Buenos Aires, although this year, and another year we went to Chile, to Santiago instead, because Buenos Aires is having so much difficulty, and then we come back and graduate in Durham. So that's sort of how the program works, and we have a total of 5 terms. The program takes 19 months. Each student takes 3 classes per term, which is a lot. I couldn't imagine 4, but 3 classes per term. Everybody visits every place, so we pack up 90 or 100 executives, and we all move to Europe, Asia, South America. And we target mid to upper level managers here. The average age of average work experience is 14 years in this program, so they're pretty up there.
What's the current price of this?
Let's see, it is 97 something. It's right under 100,000.
In most cases for this program, though, the corporations, the employer pays the bill.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's for the whole program.
That's for the whole program.
Yeah, they're running travel.
That is additional. So it's literally for the tuition. Now, remember, we have double overhead here because we don't have classroom facilities in these different locations. So we have to then rent hotel rooms and that sort of thing. So it's quite pricey. Okay? Our cross-continent program is kind of a scaled-down version of this. We start in Durham, and then we also have a campus in Frankfurt, Germany. We actually have some good partnerships in Frankfurt, so the cost of this is a little bit lower. They meet face-to-face for 1 week, and then they have 6 weeks of distance in between. At certain points during the academic year, they will actually cross continents, and they take classes on each continent. This program has 8 semesters. They're 6 weeks long, as Danny was mentioning. It's a 21-month program. They take 2 classes per term. They have classes on both continents, so everybody visits the U.S. at some point, everybody visits Frankfurt at some point. And this is targeted at high-potential young managers, those with anywhere from 3 to 8 years of work experience. So this program is a little bit different.
And they keep a resident dean in Frankfurt.
Yeah, sort of, maybe. That's kind of up in the air. But Bob will be here if you want to. Bob Ashton is our current dean in Frankfurt, so you might want to talk to him about this.
And Tom Keller was before Bob.
Tom Keller was before Bob, that's right. Just to give you what we look for, we have a highly selective participant base with very diverse backgrounds. Our goal is try to maximize diversity so that we get a good learning environment for everyone. We try to have a very discussion-oriented class because with a global audience, it's amazing what you can learn from people with some work experience, and they bring those all together. The instructor is still very much in charge. It's an instructor-led course, but the instructor is much more of a facilitator in many cases, although they still present content, and I'll show you that. We are very cohort-based. Our GIMBA program has 100 students. We break those into 2 sections of 50, but each class is a lockstep program, and they all travel together, and it becomes a very nice and tight learning environment. We are extremely team-based. Anywhere between 60 and 70% of a student's grade is determined by their team performance, and we are very much committed to that because of the richness that you can get with a collaborative environment that the technology enables. We always try to save at least some percentage where a student has some control over their ultimate grade. So 30% of a grade is individual, and that can make a difference between an HP and an SP is what our grading courses are. And that's typically what the students need, is some sense of control. And we have a mixture of place and space. This is also referred to as a blended learning model. And I think that's both what Danny is describing and sort of what Amy's describing. The way we define it is we have a pre-reading period where we ship students a package, a little present, that gives them kind of an overview of what's going to be happening during that intense face-to-face time. And what we tell them is make sure you read that because we are going to hit the ground running when you show up. Okay? First time, they ignore us. They're staying up all night. They can't, you know, they're working, getting very stressed out. After that, they understand that we're really serious about that. So read your pre-readings before you come. Then when you come to the residency, you have this intensive face-to-face time. We find that that is very important because it builds trust between the students themselves and between the students and the faculty. And it also helps set the expectations. You know, they're going to really get clear on what the professor is looking for, what sort of things are going to be expected from the program, etc. finally, it provides the content foundation that we then try to build upon in the distance portion. We've got two ways of doing that content foundation. One is what the students have referred to as the fire hose approach, okay? Where you basically teach all the content material that you need for a semester in those 2 week or 1 week programs, okay? So students say it's like drinking from a fire hose because they can't get all the information. But then you use the distance to go back, revisit, and apply those concepts. That's one method. And that works for courses, works particularly well for statistics, by the way, where you just, the professor even says, you're not going to understand this until later on, just trust me, listen, and just take in as much as you can, and it's a very highly rated course. The second method that we call, and the students have labeled the sprinkler method, okay, two water analogies, but the sprinkler method is to take a consistent pedagogy and apply it during the face-to-face setting, and then continue that same consistent pedagogy during the distance portion. And our accounting courses are a very good example of this. We typically have, in the accounting course, you talk about the concept, let's say the rules or whatever you're going to be applying. You do a numerical, hypothetical example, and then we apply it to an annual report, let's say. So we have concept, numerical example, application. And they do that at face-to-face every single day. So when they get to the distance, we still do the same thing. The students are very familiar with that, and it really lets them learn the material well. When you move it to the distance portion, we have both team-based and individual assignments, and the teams have lots of different ways that they can work together, which I'll be showing you in just a minute. Okay? We think that this is really important to have this face-to-face time, and it's very difficult for us to think about going totally without any face-to-face, mainly because it is a global program. But it does build working relationships, and it builds a social identity. These guys, one of the best kind of pieces of evidence I can give you is every class that's graduated from the Global Executive Program has given 100% to its class gift, okay? And that's pretty amazing when you think you have 40% international participants who've never heard of a class gift. You have free education. They're, first of all, paying for education. Then why would they want to leave a legacy for other people? So it really does provide a tight environment. If you did go to space only, then you'd have to shift some things over, and I think Amy gave you a good example about how to provide the content in the distance, in the distance portion, and also try to establish a community. I think that's a good example of how you might do that. Okay? Now, what I have done today is to just talk about some of the things that we've learned and things you might want to consider. And if this is, we can go into lots of different things, but you might want to consider your infrastructure and technology. I can talk a lot, I can probably talk all day on content presentation options, and I'll show you a few different things than what Amy is talking about. How to build and maintain a learning environment, a learning community with both synchronous and asynchronous channels. Logistics, how do you do exams, how do you do assignments, some of the questions that we've been having. And then I'll show you kind of what we've been doing in our accounting courses to show you how all of this can maybe work together, okay? The technology is probably, we can say your computer is your most important textbook. And because of that, we have very, very high standards. In our global program, we actually buy the computer and hand it to them. And we maintain it all the way throughout the program because it is so crucial to be online. In our cross-continent program, we just set up a spec list. So you have to have a computer that does this. And then we help the students install the software and that sort of thing. We actually had our first kind of incident with that because we're supposed to have Windows 2000 and a student showed up with Windows 95 and much of our content was just not quite on Windows 95. So we almost had to ship him home because he didn't want to upgrade, but he finally agreed to, okay? You need to make sure you have a quality ISP, and you can have cable, you can have DSL if you're in the U.S. If you're somewhere else, you don't necessarily have that option, nor can you be online all the time. People in Europe, for example, 50 cents a minute connection charge. So we try to do things that allow people to work offline and be online only for what they need to be online for. We also, even though you have a cable or broadband or a DSL line, we still require an ISP because you're traveling, and we think that you need to be able to connect while you're traveling. I'm not really trying to slam AOL here, but it is really not an internet browser. It is a community in and of itself. So So we don't let people use that as their online connection. It just does not let you get to enough stuff that you need to get to. When you are thinking about your technology, think very carefully about the policies and procedures you're going to be using to get people to work together. You know, what happens if you're in Indonesia, and we have people in Indonesia when Suharto was overturned, okay? There was a lot of turmoil there. What do you do? Okay, we also had people there in Indonesia that would just completely lose connection for a while. We've learned a lot about how to keep people informed, and that's really important, but think through how you're going to be handling lots of different emergencies or things like that. Understand limits on phone lines, firewalls, internet gateways, etc. Now, this is getting better in certain instances and worse in other instances. In China, for example, when we first started, there was only one internet gateway for the whole country. Okay, now I think they're up to two or three. They're getting better. Saudi Arabia, however, screens everything that comes in on the internet. And we had a student that had to drop out of the program because they would not allow the American business content to come into Saudi Arabia. So it was a very difficult way to do that. Vietnam has another pretty strong kind of country firewall, and different countries different companies can actually have firewalls if students are using a corporate computer. So think through those kind of things if you're actually going global. And most importantly, you need strong technical support for both the students and the faculty. A lot of you are saying, how do you have time to do this? And the first few years that we did the global program, our faculty did all of the content creation by themselves. And that is very, very time consuming. And as we have gone further and further along, we actually now have a small in-house development shop, and that's what I'm in charge of, to work with the faculty and help them create their content. And I'll show you what we do that might be easy for you to do. Started out with just one person, then two, and now we're up to seven. So we have a lot of demands coming down the line, and we are using that to help our faculty. Okay? Now, our particular environment has a customized web environment. In other words, we built it ourselves, because when we first started this program, there wasn't a platform, there wasn't a WebCT, there was nothing else out there. So we started investing in our own infrastructure, our own platform, and we've kind of stayed with it. Really just kind of gotten used to it, and haven't really, we're actually trying to look at platform, because the whole wider university is going to that, and we're trying to get our faculty to consider something else, because it is very costly to try to keep up your own platform. We have a suite of focus bulletin boards, we have our own CD-ROM material, and we do put everything on CDs because we cannot necessarily have streaming. If you have folks in Indonesia or Kazakhstan that have a very low bandwidth, you know, a 2400 connection, 9600 I've seen in certain parts, you just can't have any kind of streaming. So our philosophy is everyone everywhere must be able to access things. So we have a lot of things put on CD. We do have synchronized media presentations, which we are now tending to use Flash for those sorts of things. We have used RealPresenter, we have used Camtasia, we have used just plain narrated PowerPoint, but we're now moving more into Flash because there's a lot of advantages to that if you can get the support help to do that. We have real-time chat, we have a file submission and retrieval system, we have email that we use very sparingly. We try to keep things in a community environment, and then we have interactive learning and performance tools, basically Java-based tools that we use to help the students understand all the different things that are going on, okay? Here's our learning platform. It's very simple, not fancy. We don't have a lot of graphics because, again, going across an international audience, you can't really have a lot of bells and whistles. But we have a place for if there's an emergency announcement. Let's say the system is going down for maintenance. It comes up on the first page. Community resources are things like the library, access to the Duke University library system. Program resources, if you somehow blow away some of your software, you can come back here, download the software, reinstall it, because we have a site license for all the software. And then there's a central course calendar that we are very dependent on. And I guess one of the things about our learning platform is we're calendar-centric versus course-centric. Instead of having each professor worry about what's happening in his or her own course, we try to integrate the courses and we really have a central calendar so that two things are not due on the same day. or big projects are not all due on the same week. And that's one of the things that's difficult with Blackboard, is that cross-program stuff is not as easy to see. Each team has its own page, its own chat room, its own discussion board. They can share documents, they can collaborate all through the platform. Each person has kind of like a My Yahoo, we have a My Workspace, where they can put their own documents and talk to themselves. And then we also have courses and the people that you can see online. Now, for those of the faculty that we work with, we've learned that it takes a long time to do this preparation. I start working with the faculty member, I'll start nagging them probably 6 months ahead of the delivery of the course. And I get more insistent about 4 months. And you really, if you want to do a lot of different kinds of content that takes some programming or if you want to use Flash, then you need to use that kind of long-term. We can have text-based materials. In fact, we always provide a hard copy as well as a media copy. And again, it's because of this everyone everywhere. If something goes wrong, we want the students to be able to have access to it. So even though we have a multimedia presentation, we'll have like PowerPoint slides that go along with that to print out just in case they need that. We're hoping to move away from that more in the future as we get better technology that allows students to work that we can depend on that'll actually be there. Okay. And then we try to get three different types of content. One that just transmits information, provides a concept. Another one that provokes, that tries to get them engaged and say, okay, what would you do in this situation? And the third is something that they can use kind of as an on-the-job tool, engage and apply. Here's some examples of that. Okay. For a presentation, this is a basic Flash presentation, and this is a finance one. It just plays a power, it looks like a PowerPoint slideshow. We also have a text version for our international students in case the narration is going too fast. But you can look back and forth, you can either watch it and hear it, or read it. So it tries to appeal to multiple learning styles there. And that's really good for transmitting ideas one way, okay? We found that it needs to be short. It can't be, many of our professors want 40-minute presentations. Students won't really pay attention that long. Actually, 20 minutes is probably their max. And we keep getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Right? Coming back to what Amy said, trying to find kind of that objective that you're trying to get across. And what we try also to do is use the presentation of material to drive them to other media that will make them kind of interact with the material in a different way. Yes.
This concept of blank on a lecture doesn't really make sense. Can't they stop that for 20 minutes or 10 minutes say that's enough, but I can't handle any more of this?
They can, but what we found is that if they do stop, that means they're very frustrated and they don't typically go on. So if you can break something up take a 45-minute presentation and break it up into 10 or 20-minute chunks, they're much more likely to watch the entire content.
So it's better that you break it up rather than they break it up.
Yes. But you also have to have some indexing and that sort of thing. So it's just some things that we've learned, is that once they get frustrated with something that kind of goes on, they don't go back to it. And they then start complaining, and you get lots of emails to the professor about, I didn't understand this concept, I don't want to listen to that, tell me again how this works. So we find that if the professor can make kind of very bite-sized chunks, it works much better, and the students tend to watch it more. Amy?
Absolutely true with the representative videos. That comment you will see is too long. So I need to have it more, this is the topic that's going to cover, and that's it.
Yeah. Actually, the research on it...
I don't mean to get better. No. I'm saying if I'm going to watch an hour video, and I get tired after 15 minutes, I'll just look, pause, and then go launchers, and then come back.
I guess bottom line, if on average, students prefer bite size. And I think that's what it is.
But can't change it. Your percentage will stop.
Absolutely.
You say you can pause them, rest, take a break,
all I'm saying is that
you have that ability, and I still was criticized.
You're saying you can't pause these, though, right?
No, you can.
Well, you can't pause them, okay, well, that is, yeah.
But it's still, I think the better way to think about it is, with our learners, which are full-time workers and they're adults, they want something that they can see, kind of a complete example in a short period of time, and then try to go apply it, rather than listening to a long lecture. And if you think about sitting there watching a computer screen for a long, long period of time, it does become tiresome. The recent research on adult learners says that in a face-to-face setting, adult learners can have up to a 75-minute attention span. Okay? But online, it goes down to 15 minutes. Okay? And that's because it's just not, there are other types of stimulation around to watch. So 20 minutes is even pushing it on that sort of stuff. But we found that once we started making smaller things, we're getting much better student response, we're getting much better interaction about the content, like on the discussion board, etc. So it's just, I don't know. Plus, one of the other things we've discovered is that Flash, if you use Flash, has a bug in it that your presentations cannot be longer than 22 minutes and 13 seconds. It stops. 16 frames, 22 minutes, 13 seconds. So we either break them up or we try to get them, you know, below that in order to make them in those presentations. Okay? Second type of a way to get these students engaged is to provoke them. Okay? And in this instance, this is again another finance example, but it gives them a problem, an exercise that they're supposed to try to work. Now, we're like Amy, where we have a solution or the answer there when they can look at it, but we want them to try to work it. And once they do that, then they can come back and figure out what they did right or wrong. We typically do that in a lot of our quantitative courses, kind of for the rote practice and memorization. And we tell the students, you know, you can look at the answers if you want to, but you're going to be tested on this. Your final exam is going to have this. You need to know how to do it. So you better practice it by yourself. And we actually find that they work through that pretty well. Okay. The last one is how to engage the students. We have a lot of interactive tools that they can then take back and use in the workplace. For example, here is the currency option pricing calculator. And they can enter several different types of information. This is a Java-based tool, and it will actually calculate a price for them. And they use that to do some of their homework or case assignments, but then they can also take it back to the job. We find that this kind of real-world application, where they're able to really poke around and see different examples, helps solidify the learning for them. Okay? So at the end of this, I'm gonna disagree with both Amy and Denny and say that I think the online courses is probably, you learn more, and it's more rich than a face-to-face environment. I told you I was biased when we started. Yes? Yes. But that's another benefit of having these kinds of things, is that students can go back to it as often as they need to in order, if they are having trouble with the language. Typically, we do have TOEFL scores that we try to test. We also have live interviews, either phone interviews or face-to-face interviews for the students. But everything is conducted in English. Okay? The learning community is really a powerful thing that we try to establish. And what we have found is that we have to set expectations very early about what we need from them, what they need to be successful, and we really try to enforce those early on. And we try to encourage the sharing of personal information. You know, Amy had them post to the bulletin board a description of themselves, their AIMS, names, that sort of thing. We try to make some community space available for that. And we try to keep everyone as involved as possible in that. My job as the assistant dean of the program was to figure out who's not participating and why. And typically, it would either be a technology problem, a work problem, you know. There are a lot of different things that can go on, but we try to catch them early and basically say, are you in the community or not? and try to get them back in when they would just drop out and be off in the ozone, so to speak. And the other thing that we had to do, both for faculty and staff, and even from students to each other, is learn to provide very frequent and timely feedback. As Amy said, when she got an instant message to say, you're fifth in line, that even that little sentence of you're fifth in line is so crucial when people are literally hanging by a phone cord around the world, that just a little note that says, I've heard you, but I can't deal with you right now, makes a big difference to these sort of students. Some examples of our how to get to know people. Some of you might know Michael Smith, who's one of our professors. This is how we can sort by faculty, students, staff. We also have an indicator here of who's online. The instant messaging in this particular platform is only one way, okay? So you can't respond. I don't really like it that well. And in fact, our faculty want to be taken off. They don't want students to know when they're online. We used to use ICQ a lot, which is another one that Amy talked about. And it really can become annoying unless you're really working it like Amy does. If you're just sitting there working on something else and the students do it online, you get these messages, and it really is very, very So our faculty have asked our programmers to try to figure out a way to not show that they're online. But one of the ways that we share the information, we have the kind of the demographic information and then a brief biography of each person so you can go in and learn about them. You can also create your own contacts list by remembering that person, and it'll show up on your own workspace page. Again, very similar to Yahoo. Yes.
Not to pick on this particular individual, but say he's an assistant professor, relatively new.
Uh-huh.
In order to stay at Duke, he's going to have to publish. This, as you described, takes a heck of a lot of time. How's your reward structure built around the time of the program, and then how does it recognize the time commitment involved in all of this?
Initially, I would say it did not do very well, but in the last 2 years, the way that we've done that is to create the shop that I'm currently in charge of, where we actually work with the faculty and do the development for them. What Michael did for us is he provided us PowerPoint slides that he would do in a lecture. He recorded his lecture on a cassette tape, and we did the rest. And that's all we had to do, was just talk into a tape recorder, give us the PowerPoint slides, and then we put it all together for him. You notice that he has won many teaching awards. He was a great teacher, particularly in the face-to-face environment. He just started teaching in the distance environment. I saw him at the end of his week with the students, and he was exhausted. And I said, yeah, but, you know, a lot of your work has been done. It's now time-consuming, but it's not quite as physically demanding as the face-to-face time. So really what we tell the faculty is check, you know, mornings and right before you leave, check your bulletin boards, check for email. You know, make sure that you get back to the students within 24 hours if you can. 48 is the max. And then you can do that while you're doing other projects. And a lot of people are like Amy, where they set aside a particular time a day where they want to deal with all their teaching. And I would recommend that if you can, to kind of say, I will be available in these hours, and then not necessarily have the students kind of at your beck and call. And I would say we went overboard on that at the very beginning of the Global Executive Program, is that we were really trying to learn and we were really involved, and now we've kind of learned that we have to have some management of our time because it does take away. But like any research institution, research is number one, teaching second, service third. So that's why our shop was created, so that we wouldn't hurt the junior faculty. When I first started Gimba, the people that taught, interestingly enough, were most of our full professors, and many of our chaired professors were the ones that taught in the program. So they took the lead, and now we're starting to get more junior faculty and realizing all the time demands and trying to take care of them. Another way that we keep the community space is, this is just an announcement board. And you'll notice on here, I know you can't see it all, but we've got things like, here's what's happening at Duke, here's some new babies that are born, here's some, hey, he got a job promotion. We're starting to ship your things out there. So we try to create, just like bumping into someone in the hallway, we want this to be a lounge of things where they can go and kind of keep touch with everything in the program. And it works really well. It's very interesting to read all the different things that go on there. We've had people announce that they have cancer on here, and the outpouring of support is just incredible. It's just amazing. If you can create that space and encourage the use, it really does help solidify what goes on in the learning environment. Okay? Now, we have two primary channels of communication in terms of follow-up to the content. One is asynchronous, anytime you want to, and the other is synchronous. In the asynchronous things, we found things that are really important, like using clear subject lines. We have in some of our econ classes, for example, that are very heavily discussion-oriented, you might have 600 postings on a news group, okay? And if they all say re, and just repeat the subject, it really is difficult to scan to see where you want to zero in on comments, etc. So if you can use a clear subject line to change the subject every time, that's really helpful. And we really hammer that into the students during the first part so that they learn the norms and protocols that we want to use. And they understand later why it's so important, because they can say, who was it that said that thing on dress code in the environment? They go back to a management class and there's like 600 postings with, you know, nothing to do with dress code. But if you can start encouraging them to change the subject line, that helps. Threading, another on the discussion boards, making sure that they do kind of keep relevant comments together is also very important, because if you have just 15 different things going on, it's very difficult to see how it all fits together. We have the professors really respond and guide the discussions very closely at first, but later, many times the professors will have a team, a student team, run a discussion board, because they're so used to working in this environment, challenging each other, etc., that they can actually do a lot of it themselves. We sometimes have some professors with TAs or team monitors. And in fact, we had a professor who had a joint appointment between us and Australia, and he had a TA in both environments, and he got one of the highest records of accessibility because somebody was always online, even with the students. So whenever they posted a question with his TAs, he got an immediate response, okay? We've also had professors cold call in a class, and sometimes to keep participation rates high, I would recommend this. So, you know, John, what do you think about this? And if John's not online, one of his team members or somebody else in the class is likely to send them an email, John, you're very cold on the bulletin board, and then John would come back and respond. But it's a way to kind of keep peer pressure working together and for you, so you can actually do that in the discussion boards, okay? Now here's an example of our management.
May I have a question?
I'm sorry. Yes.
All you and anybody else is not online. I have a problem with the bulletin board because if I see a question about a problem, let's say that they're working and the student doesn't understand something, and I'm always online, so I have this tremendous urge to instantly give them the answer. And I do that, I found myself doing that over and over again, and then none of the other students would respond. And yet, if I waited for the other students to respond, not only could they possibly give them the wrong answer, but it would be much later than the student that had the initial question asked the question. So I just didn't know how to interact effectively, given that problem.
I always remember Tony Catman, was in Virginia, and then Villanova, but they have this BAM program, which actually no intermediate textbook for a whole year. The students are required to learn on their own. He says the hardest thing for a professor to do is how not to give answers. And I think it becomes an art, like when you should and when you shouldn't. But I don't think there's a bad answer to that.
Yeah, but the student at the end of the semester will complain because they said, well, but I didn't get an answer, and then I didn't know for a week, and until the end of the week, and then by then, I didn't care. You know, so I was just frustrated with the whole process by then. So it's a real, that is a real problem that you have to deal with.
Yeah, like I said, the safe thing is to get the answer right away, because then you're kind of off the hook.
Your old colleague, Ed Summerfield, talks about one of his doctoral students who won all university teaching awards, teaching tags, by the way, and then he decided he was teaching to obsolescence, so he went to this approach, round tables in the classroom and all that, and made the students learn their own, and his evaluations went from way up here to way at the bottom, and the comments was, everything I learned in this course, I learned myself. And Ed Summerfield's comment was, case closed.
I absolutely hear what you're saying. I run into that, and I force myself to give them to the end of the day, but I don't let the day go by with the money.
But Amy, one of the things you said in the paper is you sometimes answer a question with a question.
Oh,
so that's another way. I mean, you're normal because the first few times you're teaching on this, that's exactly what you probably should do to just get used to it. But if you give it a little bit of time, and if you say, does anyone else have the answer to this to help encourage that community, then I think you'll see that they will start doing it. But it's a little like, you know, kind of trying on new clothes every
right,
time.
Because when I did have a little patience where I wasn't on, when I saw somebody else respond, I was thrilled. because somebody else came on and gave this person the right answer. So,
and I think it's easier if you have a whole program as opposed to one course that's online, because you can kind of enforce these norms more enterprise-wide, universally.
Well, that's a good point. These are the policies. We're going to go to that at UConn, this thing with having a calendar where everything gets posted for due dates, that kind of thing. We're going to work more closely as a faculty, not to make sure there isn't anything major coming on. And what the way we're going to solve it is have a single course with a single calendar that has everything. One other thing, that your discussion board thing, we have an AIS prof who's doing the distance learning, and his discussion board is a single topic for a week, and he puts a student in charge, where they are the one who have to monitor the discussion, and every week it's a new student. So all he has to do is go in and make sure, he said, a lot of times he could explain it a lot better, but in the process of that student doing it. And then the fourth thing he does is at the end of the week, the student in charge has to summarize what has been discussed. So there's a synthesis posting of everything that has gone on. And I just think that's fabulous. But when you have discussion type classes with topics, they have, and every week, a new student does it. I mean, you're taking a lot of the burden and a lot of putting the board off the professor, onto the student, and then the synthesis email.
One of the things I do in orientation, which sometimes makes the faculty angry, is I say, you will learn more in this program from each other than you will from your faculty. Okay? You know, I say as much or more, actually, but I actually think they learn more from each other. And that's not to denigrate our faculty. I think our faculty are excellent in every dimension. But that's why this collaboration, if you can get it going, boy, some of the discussions and things you see, like we were studying hyperinflation, let's say. We had a person in Brazil that had lived through it, you know, 21 times and was telling us how he actually made money. We had a person in Kazakhstan who was telling us how it worked in the Soviet Union. You know, we were studying econ again when the baht collapsed in Thailand, okay? And we had one of our students write in a chat room, the marshals are here, they have a gun pointed at me, I have to get offline because they're taking all my office equipment, okay? These kind of things you just don't see in a normal face-to-face environment. With the Suharto thing, we had tanks working, I have to get offline, tanks are rolling down the street, you know, people are coming in. Those kind of things are just amazing when you get to see that on a global scale. But so if you can encourage, and I think it takes a little bit of patience and practice, and you'll find it, I think. But also consider answering a question with a question to see if you can start encouraging it. Here you notice that the professor has started a topic, and this is a case discussion in a management class, okay? What's the key problem? What are the obstacles and opportunities? And he posted these, you know, kind of a case topic sort of thing, all the different things they wanted to answer at the very beginning of this week. This is another weekly topic. This is one case they were doing. And so they did, you know, a whole week on this case, and he posted all the questions, and then students could go in and answer different points. He comes in to either guide the discussion or summarize at various points and times, but the rest of it are the students helping each other. And you can see here you can also see the need for a clear subject line, but you can also see some of the threading and how that's important for people to use in there. We also started, a lot of students, we look at sections, kind of set some norms, and some of them have started saying, if you can't do it in one screen, it's too long. So they try to enforce from peers, make it short and sweet, and make it here so they don't have to scroll. They like that very well, for some reason. Okay, for the synchronous stuff, are you laughing? Go ahead.
I think we'll go 10 to 15 minutes and have a break. I mean, a lunch break.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I might be done.
Okay, thank you.
For synchronous discussions, that we use a chat room. We are experimenting with some place where the Navy talked about using a thing called Centra. I don't know if you've seen that.
Centra and Boston Common Center, very similar, and actually we've
hours. And on a, we hold them on the weekend, mainly for international clients. The faculty kind of arrange either a Saturday or Sunday morning time, because that seems to be the best time for people globally. And you can just stay at home in your jammies and talk. And that's sort of, you know, while you're teaching, you do this once a week. It's not that much to ask for the faculty. At least they find that it's not. We found that some ways to make these more efficient are, first of all, ask students to email any questions in advance. Then the faculty can create an agenda and take the most, you know, most frequently asked questions and deal with that first in the chat, and then kind of go down and just say the idiosyncratic issues for the end. And then the other thing that we do is, these are typically not required just because of the time zone differences, but we ask the faculty to set, or a student in many cases, to save and post a log in the file so students that aren't able to attend the chat can at least get the benefit. We see a lot of people coming in here for remedial, if they haven't really understood something, when a test is coming up, participation increases, or if people are really interested in something that the faculty member might be doing research on, you'll see a lot of discussions about that. And here's a sample of a chat log. This is actually one from Catherine Shipper. And this is right before an exam. You'll notice that the student's asking a question, and Catherine answers it, and she'll, you know, they keep going back and forth. And at the end, of course, she says, oh, any more information on the final? Can you give me some clues? She's like, nope, I haven't quite created it yet. But you go back and forth, and it's a very nice way to get some detailed information very specific to an individual that's out there. And it's you do have to be able to type. We're actually looking at some technology that allows you, that is really good voice recognition, that allows you to talk. I've actually had to go in when our dean talks to the students. I've been the typist when he talks to them. So, like, don't talk about me because I'm typing for Dean Adams. Okay. The things that we've learned over the years, I think it really caused us difficulty. Remember that you have to have almost everything prepared in advance. These things go so fast that you don't have much time for adaptation. Now, if something is going really wrong, of course, you're going to have to do some adaptation. But try to think everything through as much in advance, because once a course starts crumbling, it can crumble if you don't kind of follow back up. We found that the central course calendar is really critical, that we know what everybody's covering, that we're able to coordinate. We find copyright issues, even to this day, to still be very grave. Now, you're saying you can post journal articles on a password-protected site. Some people tell us, no, you can't.
Well, it depends on the journals. All AAA journals allow you to do this, as long as it's for educational purposes, but you can't make them available to the world. You can make them available to all your students in any form.
And many of the publishers tell us that counts as inspirational use, and you can be inspired once, but the next year you have to pay more.
AAA just had a policy, basically, because of it, an educational association.
That's great.
And there are a lot of associations that do that. And so it just depends on the journal. Harvard Business Review, no.
Harvard, don't get me started. They're one of those ones that makes you go to their website to look at things, and it's only available for 48 hours. We just
so you just forget Harvard. So.
Yeah, exactly. You may need additional resources, either hard copies or CDs. You need to think through about library access if you are having a paper. Our library has to go through a proxy server. So we also, in our technical training, we have to incorporate how to help the students change those proxy servers. And if you have the ability to get some content support, either from an external outsourced provider or someone within your instructional media, Center for Teaching and Learning, whatever, I highly recommend it the first time through, because you will be able to get some good advice to help you really zero in on and make your time spent much more efficient. I learned when Chiqua took a kind of brief foray with an outsourced provider called Pensare, and I was the liaison between the faculty and the company. Now, the company later went bankrupt, but I learned a lot from that company about what to do and what not to do. But that was our first way to really kind of get our next generation of software up there. Okay? Here's an example of our course calendar, and it tells you exactly what's happening. This is for a week. So in management, you're doing virtual groups and distance management. In this a topical discussion board just on that topic. Students can go straight from the calendar, they can click and be linked right onto the discussion board. In the financial accounting course, they have kind of an HTML sheet that says you need to read this, look at this, watch this, okay, and it's all right there. And then they have some chat sessions, etc. All of that's very crucial to keeping everyone online. I don't know if you need to want to talk about this, but testing, we found that the best thing to do is have sort of take-home exams. As Amy said in her paper, you know, everything is accessible anyway, so try to create an exam that does really use their knowledge that is an open book. There are certain professors that don't do that. They have a timed exam, and we also use the honor code. And we have lots of people, okay? We have identical wrong answers on one exam. And we kind of, you can do a lot of investigation, believe it or not. We found in the properties section of a Word or Excel document, you can see who last edited it and how long they spent on it. Okay? An exam that took most of the class, like 8 hours, took one person 45 minutes. So that was a little bit of a clue to us. But there are some ways that you can kind of discover that. If you use a case as an exam, that's another thing that works pretty well. But one thing that we recommend is to set time limits. We found that the assignment expands to fit the time allowed. So if we give them 40 hours to do an exam, they'll take 40 hours to do an exam. And then that makes your grading more difficult and everything. So we try to say, spend no more than 8 hours on this. Now we don't go back into the file logs and check when they downloaded it and when they put it back. Although we're starting to build a program to do that so that we can have better access to time quizzes. But the policies for lateness with working adults, it really is important to do that. And then the honor code is really very important. And what we found with the global audience is that's a very American thing, is the honor code. Had another incident which we had two identical, almost identical spreadsheets. And we don't know how that is to happen. The two people worked at the same company in the same division. They were both in Europe, and they had gotten used to sharing sales reports and spreadsheets and that sort of thing in their company, and they didn't really think about it in their accounting class. So it was, we found out then that we didn't explain the honor code clearly enough for our international students. And this one of the guys was English, and he said, I would never, ever, you know, rat somebody else out or give my information out. It's just, you know, I just kind of overlooked it, sort of thing. So you have to explain that very, very clearly. You've already talked about different types of assignments, and we can, you know, show you some examples of that. I've sort of already indicated this, that we find that for accounting, that a concept, numerical example application is really a good way to teach this, so that it gets the students kind of in a mental groove of how to learn accounting and how to apply it, and it works very well, and then any of the questions are answered on the discussion boards or in chat sessions, okay? Ours are part-time students, I think Amy's are too. They're essentially part-time students, and you have to keep that in mind. And it's sometimes frustrating to you when you walk the exam in so you can start grading, and they're coming in very slowly. Timing takes a lot of practice and patience. You got to plan for unexpected issues, and what happens if the computer dies, it really can eat the homework, and you have to have some policies about that as well. Okay? We found that it's an extremely challenging program, but it's also a very exciting and rewarding program to work with. If you're getting into this, give yourself time to think and practice and have fun, because you learn a lot from the students, I think, in this, and it's a very rich, diverse learning program.
Good, thank you.
Thank you. We want to leave right now. We want everybody back in their seats, but we want to present. And then we'll have your questions for her. And then we're going to move to Susan Spencer. So, Crawford, I do, Nancy, we'll let you carry on.
I just wanted I told you that I thought that Flash was the tool we were using. I just wanted to demonstrate some of the benefits that we see in Flash and show you some of the interactive tools that we've been developing. I'll do it very briefly. Unfortunately, the resolution on this computer is so high that that's the size of the screen. If there's something you want to see in full screen, I have a bigger viewer, but I lose a lot of navigational control. So let's see if we can get the concept across here, and then if you want to see something, let me know, and I'll put it up in a full screen viewer. What we found, we have lots of different things here. Here's Camtasia, we use that to narrate a PowerPoint. Empatica, if you haven't heard of Empatica, what it does is take a narrated PowerPoint and compress it by 90%. So it can be streamed. It's a lot easier than, the narrated PowerPoint files are really big. Empatica just came out with a new release here that has a lot better navigational controls than it did previously. The problem there is that the sound quality also gets compressed. So always, if you're using this, record at the highest quality level, and then when it gets compressed, it's acceptable. It's not professional by any means, and in the real media. And in these, the faculty are the ones that create all the software. If they want to work with our group, we use Flash and Java, basically. Let me just show you some of what we found is that Flash is really good for animating things. And I'm going to show you a simple one here where this is from an operations course. And this is the original PowerPoint slide. Okay, there's actually that's two different slides, and a faculty member was narrating. And what we did was animate it. Presentation, we saw this slide and we thought when he was narrating it, we thought that the little red car got pulled and put to the next slide and pulled to the next slide. We showed the faculty and he was like, what have you done? And we're like, well, Paul, this is what I hear. And he's like, no, no, no. So we got a lot more information from him and we were able to animate it.
The green car, the
car,
the
car,
the green car goes to his world. The red contamination from each box, the green contamination from each box, the positive contamination, and again, the red contamination will look at the air, and the red contamination is made one.
A totally different picture of what happens, and Flash makes that possible for you to see. We can also, let me show you an accounting problem that we find that students like to see kind of a building presentation. This is a transfer pricing issue on the Hagerty fan case. If you're
the first part of Hagerty fan, we are asked whether or not the assembly would be willing to purchase the blade from blade at $6 per blade. And our answer to that question is no. Assembly will not be willing to purchase blades for $6 per blade because assembly is currently able to source this product from some external producer at $4 per blade.
We actually built this lower navigational bar based on comments from students that they can
make a book next year. Blade will then cost about $100,000 per blade.
When he developed this, she was holding the microphone and speaking into it.
He just talked into a cassette tape
recorder.
And then we take
you
the
have to merge it later. Could you get a microphone and mic at the same time?
Yeah. Well, no, you have to make a separate audio file and then...
Oh, so you can't have it all at one time.
Oh!
So, it is a little more complicated.
Yeah, I would say this is not something that a faculty member should take the time to learn necessarily. It's very, very tedious work.
Also, if you don't want to bother with Flash, PowerPoint 2000 has these animation facilities built right in. So you can do these and still stay in PowerPoint as long long as you get the latest version. But you can't play the animations in an older machine. You only have to have a player with, you know, a machine playing. It has to be on Windows 2002.
An example of pulling in a PDF file, which you can do and then draw different pictures on. A lot of different ways to add emphasis to things that are there. So we find that the students really seem to like this sort of stuff. And then the only other thing I'm going to show you are some tools that we've built. These are from the Java guys. One seems very similar to what Amy did in Flash, although this is done in HTML. And it's basically, this is for decision models, but it's trying to take students step by step through a thinking process. So it starts with, what is the problem? What are the objectives of the problem? And you're supposed to think about it. You can get a hint, or you can get the solution. What are the uncertainties? And it actually will show you, like, a decision tree in this case. Somebody is asking about how the teams work together. This is one that is also used as a faculty research project, and our guys have put a little bit of extra it's called the team dashboard, and we use this for our learning teams to check in with each other to see how things are doing. So we have them take a survey of how they're working together, are we experiencing conflict, etc., etc. How is your participation rate? Here's the emoticons that Amy talked about. We ask how you feel about working in your team. And then we have a radar screen about, are you feeling like you're inside the team or are you way outside on the edge? And it records all that along with some open-ended comments. Then when you
switch... Is this done in Java?
Yeah. This is my office mate. That beeping will not stop, unfortunately. The next version it does. But what it does is provides diagnostics for the team. So if you're in the green, you're doing okay. If you're yellow, it tells you some possible causes and ways you might fix it. If you're red, you need to really stop and talk about it because there's some problems going on. And I'm going to shut that down because I can't stand the beeping.
You've got to be a real pro after that, though. That's Java.
That's Java, yes.
Yeah.
That cannot be done probably, many faculty can, but that's probably not a good use of your time as a faculty member. So those are just some things that we've been working on, that sort of stuff.
Any questions for Nancy?
Yes. Audio and put in a new layer. So if the faculty member doesn't want Catherine Schiffer's voice in the background and then put their own in, they can even change some of the slides and we can just play a new audio track in. It all fits. It's really efficient.
It varies a lot. I understand it varies from university to university. That's hard to answer in general. Here at the University of Iowa, yes. If you're at my university, no.
Programmer, and that was back in the fall of 2000, and by today, now we're up to 7 people. There are 3 instructional materials developers, myself and 2 others, and then there are 4 programmers. 2 are dedicated to that learning platform, and then 2 more are Java. So a total of 7 people that develop materials. We do not have to support it on a 24/7. There's a separate support group that it supports our CrossCognit program, our GIMBA program, our Weekend program. And it's got about 1,200 students on that. So the support is separate from the research and development. And I don't, you know, at first we didn't actually, until the university gave us money, we didn't have the resources to put that kind of development help in that we have now. The demand is getting so high from faculty that I imagine they'll find a way to keep it going after the grant expires this
summer. So before this, faculty would be responsible for their materials?
Yes, and they would be.
They weren't nearly as sophisticated, obviously.
Well, Camtasia can do some very nice things. So it can be, I mean, it can do a lot of the similar sort of animations, but there was a kind of a quality difference depending on what technology the faculty used. And we're trying to drive more to a branded look that has, you know, similar backgrounds, navigational bars, so the students have a predictable thing to look at. And that's just the time, over time, we've come to those conclusions. I think when you're first starting out, you don't have to worry about that yet, but as you're, you know, trying to stay on the front line, you have to keep stepping up the bar.
Thank you, Nancy. That was really nice. Susan Spencer.